Welcome to Siasa, a podcast on Middle East policy and politics. I'm Ibrahim Al-Asil, and today I'm discussing the Lebanese crisis with Dr. Randa Slim. Lebanon hasn't seen a good day in a very long time, and the crisis has intensified over the last 2 years. The economy is in a free fall, and the Lebanese currency has lost more than 93% of its value against the US dollar in less than 2 years. The United Nations Children's Agency, UNICEF, reports that 77% of Lebanese families say they lack sufficient food. The UN's World Food Programme estimates that poverty in Lebanon has almost doubled this year, affecting 3 million people compared with 1.7 million in 2020. To discuss different dimensions of the Lebanese crisis, I'm delighted to have with me Dr. Randa Slim, the director of the Conflict Resolution and Track 2 Dialogues Program at the Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C. Dr. Slim is also a resident fellow at the Foreign Policy Institute at the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced and International Studies, SAIS. A long-term practitioner of Track 2 Dialogues, Dr. Slim brings a deep experience in the Middle East dynamics and conflict resolution. Dr. Slim, welcome to Siasa. Let me start by asking you about the Lebanese domestic conditions. Lebanon has been going through multiple crises, especially during the last 2 years. Where is Lebanon now?
First, let me start, Brahim, by thanking you for hosting me and wish you the best of luck with your podcast going forward.
Thank you.
And thank you again for inviting me to talk about a country that's dear to my heart, Lebanon. Where we are, this is a country that was a middle-income country 2 years ago, October 2019, and December 2021. It's now a poor country. Mm-hmm. You have between 70 to 80% are now poor. You have some 50-some percent extreme poverty. You have a lira that has lost the Lebanese pound, about 90% of its value. You have a haircuts on people's deposit that is anywhere from 85 to 70%, meaning people lost 70 to 85% of their deposits in banks. Mm-hmm. You have a health sector that is deteriorating, especially after having, you know, to deal with COVID and the repercussion of COVID. You have pharmacies that do not have medicine to sell. You have people that basically, like me, when I'm going home, I used to bring gifts. Now people ask you to bring medication and, you know, simple things as antibiotics because the country does not have them.
Right.
Or is not importing them and it's not producing them at home. And you have an education sector that is also now in shambles. The last number I heard, about 747,000 children are out of school.
Horrible.
You have more than 50,000 children who had over the last year moved from private school to public schools because their parents can no longer afford the fees. Mm. You have parents now that, according to anecdotal reports, that have to choose between feeding their kids and sending them to school because they cannot afford both. So it is a tragedy of multiple proportions, and it has happened over a very short period of time. Usually for a country to go from being a middle-income country to where Lebanon is today, it takes a number of years, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. This happened over the course of only 2 years. So it's like a major whiplash that people are still trying to deal with and internalize. And things are not set up to improve anytime in the future.
Yeah. And what led to this dire situation, Randa? Was it a direct event of what happened? I mean, we remember the explosion of the port in Beirut, and then things like if started to go in a free fall. Was the explosion the main reason, or there are other reasons that those outside the country are not really grasping about the situation in Lebanon?
The economic condition started in October 2019, way, way, way before, mm. like the banks shut down their doors and stopped people from accessing their deposits, October, November 2019. So way before the port explosion. The port explosion accelerated the decline, mm. but it did not cause the decline. Corruption caused the decline, and corruption over many, many, many years. A dysfunctional political system caused a decline. A ruling elite that is united, you know, despite their political ideological divisions, gets united around the plundering and the theft of public goods and public money. Mm. You have a political system that has been dysfunctional. You have an economic system that has been living outside its means. You know, people have been living outside their means anyway. You have a country that hasn't have economic policy that is based on sound economic policies. You have a banking sector that over a number of years engaged in this kind of engineering schemes, you know, with high interest rates that eventually bankrupted the country. So a lot of these developments were in the making for many years, and they came to a tipping point around October, November 2019, and then this continued. And then COVID hit the country, and then you had the explosion. So it was many, many crises, but the real, you know, the structural causes of these many crises have been in the making for many, many
years. You mentioned three main issues. You mentioned corruption, a dysfunctional system, and the rule of the elite. If we look at the uprising or the protest of October 2019, I think those are what the protesters were chanting against. But what happened with the mobilization of people? Were they able, the Lebanese street, to achieve anything since October 2019? And if not, why? Why they were not able to achieve what they tried to achieve in the streets?
Look, I think what happened is COVID happened. Remember that the protest movement happened in October 2019, and then it continued for a while, and then the state, you know, the security services, in collaboration with some of the groups, particularly Hezbollah and the M, really started to the use of disproportionate amount of violence to try to bring this protest down. So add COVID to that, which basically put the country into lockdown. Those two factors combined together. I think what happened there is similar to what happened to the rest of the Arab Spring, is that fatigue set in because they were not able to deliver short-term tangible results. Mm. And because the system in this kind, although it's a dysfunctional system, but the political elites, business elites came together with the security services to against this uprising. And they were able to rally their forces to be able to bring this uprising down. And then add to that COVID. So what happened in Lebanon is very much similar to what happened to the rest of the region in terms of the Arab Spring. Mm. You had a number of, you had fatigue because people are not able to reach results and success quickly. You had a counter-revolution movement and led by different, you know, forces and groups, as well as funded by some regional countries. In the case of Lebanon, it was not funded by the countries that funded the counter-revolution in Egypt or, you know, in other countries. But in Lebanon, it was mostly Hezbollah and Amal, along with some parties of the oligarchy working successfully, in my opinion, to press and to instill fear, and on the other hand, to co-opt. And that's what usually they have been good at in Lebanon, these political elites. You know, they try to create fear of civil war, that if we were to continue with this, there will be civil war, and people still have the memory of civil war. And if this doesn't work, they use violence. Right. And if this doesn't work, they use cooptation.
And you mentioned the regional dimension, which is so interesting, especially when we talk about Lebanon. The regional intervention in Lebanon started way probably along with the establishment of Lebanon. With the civil war in 1975, it intensified. We have the Syrian intervention, we have the Israeli intervention, and then we have the influence of the Iranian and the Saudi in Lebanon. Let's start by talking about Saudi and the latest diplomatic crisis. So it started with the comments from the information minister, Josh Kardahi, about the Saudi role in Yemen. Saudi decided to disengage from Lebanon. Could you explain to us the rationale, the Saudi rationale behind that movement to disengage from Lebanon? What do they think they can achieve by disengaging totally from the country?
I think what happened recently was the latest action in a policy, in a Saudi policy of disengaging from Lebanon. And it started way back when the current king, King Salman, assumed, you know, became king.
2015.
And at the time, there was a deal done by the late King Abdullah in working with the French to, I think, help the Lebanese army, you know, get weapons from France to the tune of $3 billion, which was going to be financed by the Saudis. Mm. And when King Salman assumed the throne and the crown prince became, you know, in charge of defense and security issues, right away that agreement was nullified by the Saudis. And that was, in my opinion, the beginning of disengagement. Mm. I think there is now the current leadership in Saudi Arabia, especially led by the crown prince Mohammed bin Salman, that feels that years of investments, financial investment, political investments of Saudi Arabia and Lebanon have gone nowhere, and that putting any new money, you know, assisting Lebanon with any new financial aid is like, you know, throwing good money after bad. Mm. They feel that the country is already controlled by Hezbollah and by Iran, and that basically it's a sinking ship, and that why invest in a sinking ship? And if Iran and if Hezbollah would like to control Lebanon, you know, let them be. It is a sinking investment anyway. So why would they come in and help in any way to prevent that downfall from happening? I personally see this policy, the Saudi policy, as short-sighted. In fact, you know, today, Mr. McGurk, in an interview, he said that the American officials told the Saudi official that this boycott of Lebanon, this latest decision to boycott Lebanon, was not a smart move. Lebanon, as you said, has always been a proxy theater for regional players. I don't think the Saudis are going to re-engage the way in the same way in the past, partly because they don't see their region role in the same way that previous Saudi elites thought of their regional role in the region. They are, especially this current leadership, and especially the crown prince, is very much motivated by domestic, you know, policies and domestic priorities, like, you know, the U.S. president is motivated by domestic priorities. And they feel putting money in a country like Lebanon, which is corrupt, which is under Iran's control, taking money away from Saudis to put it in Lebanon is not a sound policy, as far as they think. Does not, and strategically in the long term, does not make sense for them.
And from what I understood from you, you mentioned Britt McGurk, who is the National Security Council Coordinator for the Middle East and North Africa. You said he's not happy, or he's trying to discourage the Saudi from their disengagement. So does the U.S. wants to see a bigger role for Saudi Arabia and Lebanon?
Look, the U.S. has now for some time been trying to play more and more an indirect role in the management of conflicts of the Middle East, whether it is in Yemen or whether it is in Syria, whether it is in Libya, whether it's in, I mean, less, more so in Iraq, I think, than these other three countries. Mm. But they are trying to not disengage, but to have that role of managing conflicts and dealing with conflicts more and more delegated to regional countries, to regional organization, to multilateral organization, as much as possible, try, you know, to lead from behind if they can, and sometimes not lead at all. And I think that's what's happening with Lebanon, is that one, they have, I mean, and again, Mr. McGurk said it today, this morning, in the same, you know, conversation he was having, is that the priority of this administration is to prevent failed states in the Middle East, because failed states create vacuums, and vacuums are mined by non-state armed actors, whether it's Hezbollah in Lebanon or whether it's ISIS and Al-Qaeda in Iraq and Syria. And so their priority in Lebanon is to prevent a failed state. and a boycott of Lebanon by Gulf countries, which are a major destination for Lebanese export, is going to, in a way, bring the countries to an even worse shape than it is already. It already is, and is going to create more of a political crisis among the different Lebanese communities and political paralysis than Lebanon is already suffering.
For the Iranians, how do you see their role in Lebanon? And this question is twofold. Part of it, I want to start by talking about Hezbollah domestically. How much of the Lebanese state institution is really under Hezbollah now, under their influence? And then what Iran is trying to achieve in Lebanon? And do you think they are succeeding in their strategy or not?
There are many people who think Iran controls Lebanon. I'm not of that opinion. I think Iran does not get involved in Lebanese retail politics. I think there is an understanding between Iran and Hezbollah about what are the contours of Iranian interests in the region, including in Lebanon, and the relationship between Hezbollah and Tehran is now of a kind that it's the trust in that relationship is at a level that it doesn't require Tehran to get involved, as I said, in the minutiae of Lebanese politics. They totally trust Hezbollah to do that out of knowledge that Hezbollah is good at managing Lebanese politics, but also out of respect for Hezbollah and Hezbollah's role in Lebanon and in the region. Now, what are Iran's interests? I mean, Iran's interest is very much power projection in the region, ensuring that it has a role in the politics of the region. And in the case of Lebanon, I mean, Hezbollah's weapons have had for some time now two functions. They have definitely a deterrence function vis-a-vis Israel in Lebanon, and I truly believe there is a mutual deterrence equation that has been established between Israel and Lebanon, partly thanks to Hezbollah's weapons, but also the second important function of Hezbollah's weapons, which is to prevent deterrence against Israel for Iran and for the regime in Damascus. And that's the problem. I think you can get the Lebanese to agree on the first function of Hezbollah's weapons, which is deterring an Israeli threat against the homeland. But it's very difficult. There is no consensus whatsoever on the second function of Hezbollah's weapons, which is to be part of the deterrence equation for the Iranian regime against Israel, as well as for the Assad regime against Israel.
And of course, Hezbollah played a significant role in Assad's survival in Syria during the civil war in the last decade. The intervention of Hezbollah started as early as 2011, and by 2013, their fighters were deployed across Syria. Now, what do you think we need to keep our eyes on when we think about 2022 and Lebanon? What are the main issues that we need to follow to know where the country is headed?
There are elections that are scheduled sometime in 2022. You know, we don't know when exactly. You know, some of the reports says they're going to be held in March. Others says no, in May. So the elections will happen. I don't expect the elections to make a major change in the political scene in Lebanon. But like in Iraq, I think the elections, given the level of anger that exists now among large swath of the Lebanese population against the ruling elite, given the higher level of engagement with politics among Lebanese, then partly because of the October protests, but also because of the economic situation and how it has affected their livelihood. So I expect the elections maybe to bring new voices into the parliament and new faces into, you know, the country's politics, but not too many, you know, maybe 10 to 12 new members of parliament, but that's a beginning of change. So we need to look at the elections and what they produce, and hopefully they produce this some change, but we have to manage expectation about how much change. I don't think we're going to see a major, I mean, drastic change in the makeup of the parliament. But as I said, some new voices. We need to look at the economic picture. I think the economic picture is not set to improve anytime soon. And that's going to have some security implication. I mean, until now, the security situation has held together. So, I mean, we have had, you know, random episodes of violence here and there. But as the economy deteriorates, I'm afraid that this might have an effect on the security situation. And we might start seeing more violent events around the country. Mm-hmm. I don't foresee a civil war anytime soon because nobody is interested in having civil war. And because, you know, there is one force called Hezbollah and there is no other comparable force, you know, to engage in a civil war. But I think we might see more effect of the deterioration of the economic situation on the security situation itself.
Okay, that's very important. So elections and economy. A quick question about the elections. There is a big mobilization for the Lebanese diaspora to go and vote. Do you think that might change or it will just reflect the same composition that we've seen before inside Lebanon?
You know, we don't know because, as you know, I mean, there is a debate now and there is a challenge in front of the I think, Supreme Court about whether the diaspora can vote for, like you do in Lebanon, for in your district, in your place of origin, mm-hmm. or whether the diaspora can only vote for 6 parliamentary seats, you know, because the electoral law was changed and then there was challenge to the amendments of the electoral law to limit how much influence the diaspora can have, mm-hmm. and the challenge is mounted by the party of the current president. So until we know whether the diaspora can vote like the rest of the Lebanese for all the seats, if they want, you know, versus whether they can vote only for 6 seats, I think that's going to determine how much of an impact the diaspora vote will have on the election.
Dr. Randa Slim, you are one of a few analysts who can really help us understand what's going on inside Lebanon within the bigger picture of the region, given all your experience in the regional dynamics. Thank you so much. I'm grateful for the time you gave us. I know that you are traveling, so I wish you all the best on your trip. Stay safe and take care.
Thank you very much for sharing your podcast with me. Thank you.